Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Author Anne Royfe was nearly 70 when her husband Herman passed away in 2005. In the days, weeks, and years following, Anne had to adjust in ways she never anticipated. Now in her new memoir, Epilogue, she examines the day-to-day process of remaking a life after the loss of a life partner. This hour on Point, Anne Royfe on love, grief, and renewal. You can join our conversation. Have you lost a spouse? What did you have to relearn? Joining me now from New York City is acclaimed author Anne Royfe. Since her first book was published in 1967, she's written 9 novels and 3 memoirs, as well as frequent essays and reviews for The New York Times, Vogue, and The Guardian, and many other publications. Her latest book is Epilogue, a memoir. Anne Royfe, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me here.
Appreciate it. This is a very personal work, this book, Epilogue, and it has characteristics of a journal or a diary in parts. Was it always planned that you'd publish this?
Yes, because I'm a writer who publishes. Therefore, when I sat down to write, I always knew that I was aiming my words towards someone else, towards the reader that you imagine in your mind.
You say, right out of the gate in this book, grief is in 2 parts. The first is loss. The second is the remaking of a life. This is a book about the second part of grief, isn't it? About restructuring yourself.
Yes, that's the part that interested me the most, because that's the part that required struggle and where I think I was called on to actually do something. Grief happens to you. You endure it. You survive it. You live through it. But remaking your life is something that requires invention, energy, persistence, hope, all kinds of other things that are active things.
So tell us briefly what happened. I said in the introduction your husband died suddenly after a very happy 39 years together.
Well, we had a very good marriage. We had a yours, mine, and ours marriage. We had he had had 2 children from a previous marriage, and I had had 1, and we had 2 together, all girls. We managed to get closer and closer with every passing year. Then in 2005, in December, we went to a concert. We went out to dinner with friends. We were walking home on a very cold, windy block. And as we entered the lobby, he had a massive heart attack, and he died at my feet. He was older than I was. It was not a great shock that I would lose him. But since I wasn't expecting it at that moment, and death, of course, is always terrible, it was very hard to overcome the images in my mind, the moment of loss, the experience itself. But, of course, with each passing day, many of those images faded at least sufficiently.
Will you read from the book? I'd like to hear some of the emotion behind this. You describe it so beautifully yourself, but read from Epilogue. The first reading, I think, is page 24, where you talk about your emotion and what went into that.
Just one second while I get there. I'm here. Shall I start at the top of the page? I think perhaps...
Before H died, tears used to erupt from my eyes.
I'll do that. Before H died, tears used to erupt from my eyes at TV commercials, with children running into their father's arms and dogs licking the hands of their owners. Tears used to flow at happy endings in movies and at sad endings in movies, and many of my book pages are stained with tears. Tears apparently are easy when the situation that evokes them is pretend. Girls, after all, are allowed to cry, even if it turns the nose red and the eyes become swollen. But when something shocking, real, happens, it isn't so easy to let tears fall. H used to say that women often cried when they were angry. I suspect he's right. But I am angry, and I still don't cry. I also haven't torn my clothes or shaved my head or bathed the moon. I understand those gestures belong to grief, but they seem as alien as if I were to paint my body blue and dance stark naked down Fifth Avenue with bells on my toes. Tears seem to be unrelated to sorrow, at least my sorrow, which I feel like a weight in my chest, like a knot in my stomach, a dull pounding in my head. I wonder what other people's sorrow feels like. Is it like mine? Evasive, boarded up, avoided, ready to burst out, curled up, hidden even to the self. Also, I feel tears appearing at the edges of my eyes. I become afraid. Is it possible that I could dissolve in tears? The body is 90% water, they say. What if all the inner structures, all the sinews and arteries and brain tissue collapsed as I cried? What if I couldn't stop it if I started? My task at the moment is not to float away, not to crumble or dry up or rot with water damage. My task is to manage.
What was the most penetrating emotion as you were trying to manage and going through these incredible emotions? You talk so much about loneliness. Was that the most penetrating emotion that you felt?
Well, probably loneliness is the sharpest dagger in the heart. But I would say that anxiety was a close second. And actually, I'm not a particularly anxious person. I'm not afraid of bugs. I'm not afraid of planes. I'm not afraid of all kinds of things. But in the moment of extreme grief, I became terribly anxious. The door that I locked I would not be able to unlock. The place I was going, I had the wrong address. I wouldn't be able to find a taxi. I became terribly afraid of just being in the world as if everything had changed, whereas really the only thing that had changed was that my protection and my partner was no longer with me.
Do you think adjustments to the loss of your spouse, you talk about these mundane things, locking the front door, keeping up with the contents of the refrigerator, managing your finances, doing things that your husband had always done. Were the adjustments to the loss of him more difficult as you were older? Were they more difficult to make later in life?
Well, of course, I can't completely answer that because this loss did happen to me when I was nearly 70. It did not happen when I was 40. But I have a feeling that the experience I went through was exactly the same as it would have been if I were 40. Mm. Because what happened was my sense of space changed. If I put my arm out on the bed, there wasn't anyone there. If I came into the door and I looked around, there was a kind of silence in the apartment that I wasn't used to. And I think those are not age-specific responses, but human responses to severe loss. And I suspect children feel them in their own way.
Mm. You write in the book Epilogue, Anne Royfe, that time is said to be the widow's friend, although you're not so sure that's the case. Does the pain subside? You're a couple of years out after having written a book now. I mean, after losing a loved one in some ways, does the pain subside or does it intensify?
Well, I'm sure that's a fairly individual question, and I don't want to answer it for everybody because I suspect each person's path, weaves and goes up and goes down in its own way. I will tell you that for me, the acute pain has certainly subsided. The anxiety has subsided. My appetite for living has come back. My appetite for being with my children, for walking in the park has come back. But that doesn't mean that the underlying sorrow has gone away. It just means that it's kept in a place where it doesn't destroy everything else that's going on in my life.
You talk about this restructuring, about restructuring yourself after the loss of a spouse in this book so beautifully. And I wonder if you'd tell us, how did you start to do that? What are the mechanics of that?
Well, it's a little hard for me to tell you exactly what I did. I tried to write down what I did so that I could look back on it and so that I could communicate it to someone else. I think the thing that happens is as simple as one foot in front of the other. Yes, I really didn't know how to shop because my husband had done all the shopping. But I go to the grocery store. I do shop. I bring the groceries home. I put them in the refrigerator. And then I've done it. And ever after, I can do it. So that I think it's just simply the process of living as you intended to live. I took a course. I taught a course. I called up friends. I went to dinner when anyone asked me, with anyone who asked me. I engaged myself in the world out there. Sometimes I had to push myself. Sometimes I would get out, and the minute I was out at a friend's and with other people, I would want to go home. And I would stay as long as I possibly could, and then I would go home. But gradually, I got more and more comfortable, so that I believe it's just doing. Forcing yourself sometimes, trying. Time, of course, helps, I suppose. But most of all, what helps is that somehow we are constructed as human beings not to suffer endlessly. And therefore, the acute suffering just dies down, the way you turn the radio slowly, slowly off.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour with Anne Royfe. She's author of Epilogue, a memoir. Anne, tell us about the time a few months after your husband's death when your daughters placed a personal ad in the New York Review of Books. Tell me about that, and what did you think when they did that?
Well, first of all, you have to know that my husband had always said to me that it would be a sign of the goodness of our marriage if I was able to go on in my life and reconnect to someone else, or at least go on and be happy. I had told that to the children. These are grown young women. They decided that I really needed to meet somebody. I really should go out into the world. And they decided to place this ad for me. I never looked at the ad. They told me I didn't look at it. I got terribly embarrassed. I thought, oh my God. But letters began to come, and I decided to meet some of my correspondents. I think it was an incredibly loving thing they did for me.
Do you know what the ad said?
Well, I didn't until a few, maybe even after Epilogue was published, someone showed it to me. I didn't want to know. Huh. I hoped that they didn't use cliches. I hoped that they said something that was relatively true and that these correspondents responded to something true, but I didn't know.
And was it eventually after you found out what it said?
Yes, it really was. It was extremely accurate.
So what was it like as an older woman forced back into the world of dating?
Well, I feel, and I felt from the very beginning, this is really an adventure. This is very interesting. And the thing that's interesting about it is that as I would have dinner with a particular man, I would hear stories about his life, about his children. These are people who had lived a long time, as I have. So there were many stories, there were many events. And it was in some way broadening and livening and pulling me back into life to listen to other people, to hear what mattered to them, what had happened to them. Mm. This, when I was dating in my mid-20s, would not have interested me that much. I would have been much more interested in what they thought about me. Mm. Now I was just really listening, and that was interesting. Mm.
Pulling me back into life. I like that phrase. You talk a lot in the book about wanting to avoid the trap of self-pity. You call it the graffiti of the heart. Read from the book, would you? I think it's page 184. You talk about that self-pity and the graffiti of the heart, how it's not easy to avoid.
I am here, and I start. I am concerned about self-indulgence. It is so easy to fall into that swamp. I know ways to resist that error. If I use fewer words, I risk it less. If I bind myself to the rock of reason, I will survive the inner storm. If I don't allow generalizations, cliches through the gates, I can protect myself from bad manners, from most sloppy thinking. But if I slam the door too tightly on the emotions that roll in and out with daily tides, I will become robotic, mechanical, unrecognizable to my own eyes, and useless to anyone else. Mawkishness, murky, exaggerated emotion, insincere because it has been heated up beyond truth, mawkishness is a sin against the mind. H would hate it. He preferred the Dutch masters to the Baroque Italian. He preferred Mozart above all. He cried sometimes at movies at a child's illness, pretending he was not, tears misting up his glasses. I always knew why he was crying, which was a good thing, because he would never have told me. I promise myself that I will censor the sentimental in me. But I cannot depend on the fact that I will recognize it when it comes. Self-pity is the graffiti of the heart, but not so easy to avoid. I don't want to wallow, but I begin to see that wallowing is a chronic malady, easy to condemn and hard to cure.
Have you cured it?
Well, that's a good question. I think I have mostly conquered it, but that doesn't mean that every now and then I catch a glimpse of something out of the corner of my eye. I open a drawer and I see his watch in it, and suddenly a kind of full emotion comes back over me that is honest and real, but maybe carrying more than it should. And, you know, it's not that anybody's mind can control the emotions. We really can't. And sometimes, you know, sometimes we just go overboard in ways that are not helpful and probably pretty silly.
Let's go to the phones. Anne Royfe, I'd like to bring our callers into the conversation. Many would like to speak with you. First up is Marilyn, who's in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly.
Appreciate your having me on.
Go ahead.
I also lost my husband in the year 2005 on Mother's Day. And it was a shock to me. I think I believed I could keep him alive through sheer strength of love. And it didn't work. And I've noticed that I've really lost my identity. And I wonder how common this is. And I've also lost my judgment. I find I cannot trust my judgment. Mm. And this is especially distressing to me. Mm. I don't know what happened to them. There's something in the grief process, I guess, that caused them to fail. And so I just wondered if your guest had some comments on this.
Marilyn, thanks so much, and take good care. Anne?
Yes. This loss of judgment is something that I recognize, and the sense of abandonment and the thought that perhaps you could have kept him alive if you had just loved him better, if you hadn't turned that corner but had turned another corner. I think that's very common. The loss of judgment, I think, has to do with a whole flooding of the emotional system, a flooding of the brain I think you have to think of it as if you were under siege, as if there was a flood that had taken over your house, taken over everything. How could you possibly have sound judgment under such a massive assault? I think that people also, I've heard from other women that they've had the same experience I had of losing things. Mm. You know, where are the keys? Where are my glasses? Where is my money? Mm-hmm. What did I do with that package I just had in my hand? There's a sense of being overwhelmed about the smallest of things as well as the larger things. I think this, and my judgment I know, you know, of course, none of us ever knows how good our judgment about anything really is. Only time proves you one way or another. But I think that that it comes back, that basic good judgment, basic knowledge of how to live your life does come back in time because you're less overwhelmed. Mm. And that, I think, that is something that automatically will happen and does happen. It might take 5 years for one person and 6 months for another, but I believe it will happen.
There's a bit of hope there in that. Thanks, Marilyn, for your call. Here's another one. Dee Dee is calling from Edisto Island, South Carolina. Hi, Dee Dee. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you so much for having this. It's wonderful, and I agree with so many things you said. I lost my husband 22 months ago. He was age 59, and he had cancer of the throat, and he was ill for pretty much of semi-invalid for almost 7 years. I looked after him by myself, and he was my only family member that I had left, and no children, pets, which had been great. But I just wanted to say that so many things about this, the loneliness is very difficult, and just the loss of identity, trying to reinvent yourself, remaking your life, the anxiety, and just the total feeling of being overwhelmed. And at first, I felt like my heart had just been cut out, and I'd been dropped on another planet, and I didn't even know where I was or what. And it's the self-pity is a difficult issue, but time does help, but it for me, I think I have a long way to go as far as accepting this and trying to figure out, you know, what to do with my life as a single person at age 60.
Mm. Dee Dee, thank you so much for calling. You hear it, Anne, in this caller, Dee Dee, in Maryland, these universal emotions that are felt. You write in the book about the sisterhood of widows. When you hear these callers and when you meet others who've been through this experience, what do you say, what do you mean by that sisterhood of widows?
I mean almost what you just said, which is the feelings are shared, the feelings are known. They're hard to explain to a person who hasn't felt them, but they're instantly known. I understood what this woman who lives in a different city from me, is a different age than I am, is clearly different in so many ways, and yet I feel I understand exactly what she's saying and exactly what she's living through. And I do think that that creates a bond. I think we women are particularly fortunate in being able to connect easily to each other and to hear each other. I heard her, and I know she would hear me.
Let's go to another call now. Irene is in Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Irene. Welcome to you.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, your program is really wonderful, but I thought I would share a little thing that I went through. My own mother died when she was 29 of childbirth, and my grandmother used to always talk about heartache, and I really, you know, thought she just felt bad. But my husband just died in March, and the pain is physical. I ended up in the emergency room with pains in my chest. The pain was so real. And the other thing, she used to talk about scalding tears. And I cried so much by myself, not in front of other people, until my eyes, I couldn't see out of them. So I thought something was the matter with my eyes. And grief, I know, takes a long, long, long time to get over. But everyone in life has to go through it at some time or another. That's why it was really good to hear this author talk, because I don't think people really realize. You see other people, well, they probably hide it like I do, and because you know life has to go on, that's the way things are. But as I said, it was so overwhelming to have the physical pain, and now I realize that it's something you go through, and the only way I cope with it right now, I'm going to take a course to be an advocate for the people in nursing homes who don't have any people. And that will give me some comfort, because oftentimes things happen in nursing homes, and there are some people who have no children or anyone to turn to. And also, I belong to an organization that visits, you know, older people or young people, anyone who's cut off.
You're finding ways to help others in your own healing. Irene, thank you so much for the call. The caller talks about the physical pain, and I think that's such an important point. You speak of that in your book, Anne Royfe, that physical pain, the actual stinging of the heart.
Well, I was interested in this whole expression of the scalding tears.
Yes.
I had always thought that was a kind of cliche. I thought, you know, you say I had hot tears came, you know, it was an exaggeration. But actually, tears are hot. And I discovered this just a few years ago. I discovered this with the death of my husband. Tears can get hot. What that means is that I don't know scientifically what's happening, but I do know emotionally what's happening is that it is so strong that somehow the water is almost heating up like your soul is heating up. I do think that the caller has come to a kind of solution, which is you have to turn your energy towards other people, and you have to do something for someone, to engage in any way with someone is life-saving. And, you know, if you go out to dinner with friends or if you go to a movie with friends, that's lovely, but you are still alone. They are usually in a couple. They're with somebody. You have an absence around you. But when you're doing something, then that absence disappears.
Talk more about that, Anne, because in the book you mentioned that. You talk about being the extra woman in the world of couples that you and your husband once inhabited. What was that like, inadvertently being left out of the conversation? Or did you take yourself out of the conversation? I mean, how did that work?
Well, a little bit of both. If there was a lot of talk about travel, after all, I had gone nowhere. If there was a talk about something that happened, a wonderful restaurant these two people had gone to, I suddenly realized I hadn't gone to a nice restaurant in a long time with the person I wanted to be with at that restaurant. So I think that the experience of being with other people, especially at first, especially people who are in couples, is hard. It underlines what you are not. That doesn't mean it should be avoided. I think that I've come through that. I don't pay any attention to that feeling anymore. I get little twinges of it, but I just now shake it off, because after all, I have my life to live, and it's worth it, even if I'm alone.
So when you feel the urge to get home and throw yourself under the covers, you throw off that feeling, and like you said before, take one step at a time, one foot in front of the other.
Absolutely. And I think that it no longer shocks me. I'm no longer surprised that I've gotten used to the fact that I do not have an other, at least now, and that I had another. And I am able to, you know, access that sense of the comfort that he would give me. If he were there, he would say, "Oh, please, it's not that serious." And I know that. I hear that voice. And he's right. It's not that serious. Go enjoy your dessert.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about losing a spouse and what happens to the one who's left behind. We're speaking this hour with Anne Royfe. She's the author of Epilogue, a memoir, and I'd like to go back to the phones. First up here, Dorothy is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for calling.
Not at all. What I really wanted to say was I am a psychologist. I am also a widow, and I'm doing a group now at the hospital, a local hospital, supporting widows and widowers over the age of 55. Two quick points. One, I think a slow death is different, the recovery, if you will, in quotes, than a fast death, a sudden death, like sudden cardiac arrest. Also, the second point I'd like to hear Anne Royfe talk about is the burden of linear recovery that we have. You know, you think you have to do what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked about, is go through stages, and then you're all cured. And I find for the women in the group that they see this as a terrible burden because it's X 3 years out or 4 years out and they're not feeling wonderful. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the burden and the self-pathologizing that comes with that. Mm. Thank you.
Dorothy, thank you. Answer her second question first.
I do think there's a burden placed on widows to recover as quickly as possible for their children, for the people around them, and of course their own desire to do so. And it is far more difficult than anyone could possibly have imagined, and it is not linear. You don't continually wake up every morning feeling just a little bit better, as you might if you had cut your leg in some way. The healing isn't like that. It's just like being in a certain kind of landscape and getting more used to it. It's just that there's changes of one kind or another. And I imagine the sorrow stays one's entire life. I don't imagine it as ever disappearing entirely. I think the Kubler-Ross stages are may or may not apply better if you are the dying person. I'm not really sure about that. But my life experience has been that a lot of the things the culture tells us are just not true, and that one needs to be extremely cautious. Adolescence doesn't end on your 20th birthday. Latency doesn't end the day you turn 10. Life is so much more unruly than all of those people who try to create a system for us to live in could possibly imagine. Mm.
For Dorothy's first question, I'd like to bring in an expert now who can shed some light on all of this, more broadly speaking as well. Joining us from San Francisco is Brian DeVries. He's a professor of gerontology at San Francisco State University and an expert on grief, bereavement, and widowhood. Brian DeVries, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane, and hi Anne as well.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you for joining us, Professor DeVries. The caller had an interesting point about slow death and how that's different in the recovery process from sudden death, the sudden loss of a spouse or someone close to us. How does that affect recovery?
You know, the research on that area is a little ambivalent, but there is some suggestion that being able to anticipate the death also allows an individual some what they've called anticipatory grief, so that some of the efforts in grieving that loss and in appreciating what life might be without that person, some of those efforts have been expended prior to the death and then may bolster the person following the death. And so there might be some opportunity, to sort of ameliorate or to intervene in that process through some of the experiences actually prior to the death. Mm.
From your extensive research, you say that grief is not a medical condition, and to treat it as such, as a disease or a condition, really misses the point, that it's a natural process that achieves a specific function or functions. What are those functions, Professor?
Yeah, and I was so pleased to hear both Anne and Dorothy, the previous caller, speak of that. In some ways, I feel that it's sort of a natural extension of the sort of reach of medical sciences to think of grief in this more medical way, and that's infiltrated to the extent that we hear people talk of recovery. But if we really think of grief as really the essence of us as people in the relationships we have with those around us and with those we love, it doesn't make sense to recover from such love or to recover from such relationships. And so I think, as I hear Anne speaking and what she's written in her book, and really several of the other callers too, talk of the sort of really basic nature of ourselves in the relationships with these people and that we've lost, and really it does a sort of disservice to those deep intimate ties to think that we could ever recover from them. Mm-hmm. Of course, we will live with, as one of the callers said, the pain in my heart. We will learn to live differently. We will learn to do so, and the process may be troublesome and difficult and hurt, but it is ultimately the success of us as humans to be able to endure such pain and to move forward and to find ourselves in these new environments and new situations some of whom will ultimately thrive.
Let's go back to the phones. We have so many callers lined up. I want to get you in here. Barbie is on the phone from Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Barbie. Welcome.
Hi. How are you today?
Hi. Fine. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
I'm a little choked up because I lost my father, and I lost my father-in-law in the last 3 years. And, you know, we're trying to help both moms cope with this.
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Yeah. What is the
hard? Very emotional.
What's the hardest part for you and for your family?
Well, you know, heartache in their life is moving on and knowing that there's, you know, life after death for them. And it's as a young person, you know, I've experienced many loss. Just in 1 year, I lost a girlfriend, an uncle, a job, and my father. And it hurts. I mean, I can relate as a young person.
Barbie, thanks so much for your call. Please take care. And I hear you wanting to get in here.
Yes, actually. What I wanted to say is that children have a very important role to play for their parents. I think it isn't that they need to do this particular thing or that particular thing. It isn't bringing a cake on Thursday or going to the movies with them on Sunday. I think it's staying in constant touch. How are you? For a long time, the only thing that mattered to me in my life was when my children called. That it changed the day. It changed the hour. It made such a huge difference to know that they were there. The other thing that you can do for them is to live as well as possible yourself. Because nothing makes me happier than the thought that my children are happy somewhere. They're doing, they're teaching, they're in the playground with their children, they're somewhere enjoying something. And that gives me great pleasure and great hope for the future. And I think that that's what you do for your mother and your mother-in-law, is that you live as well and as lovingly as you can.
Professor DeVries, would you add to that?
Yes, I would, although clearly not as elegantly as Anne's been able to. But I do think that as a society and certainly as a profession, we've come to treat grief sort of individually, as if, for example, the loss of my father, who died a year and a half ago, was the only loss that I was grieving. And it was certainly a primary loss, but in addition to that loss are all the other losses that I've experienced. And as Barb was saying in her call as she spoke, you know, that there were several losses, and I think we have to give ourselves some credit and some space to recognize that each loss probably rekindles those losses that have gone before. And moreover, for her, as for me, the death of my father really meant not only the absence of that person in my life, but the way in which I was now changed, too. And so I am grieving for who I no longer can be. You know, I am not that son in his eyes. Or I am not that partner for my spouse who may have died. And I think there are multiple griefs, and to be aware not only that each loss is not on its own island, but within each loss, there are multiple losses.
Let's go back to the phones now. Debbie from Pepperell, Massachusetts, is on the line. Hi, Debbie. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I have actually a different question than what I wanted originally answered because of everybody talking about it. I'm now 45. I have a family. I've been with my husband for 20 years. I have two kids, a 16 and a 7-year-old. In 2004, my mother passed away on February 3rd, day before my daughter's birthday, from cancer that ended up going into her brain. 6 weeks later, approximately, my dad, on April 9th, it was his birthday on the 4th, he passed away suddenly. Now, my mother had a heart attack and then a second heart attack. Now, they were separated for years, and my mother had remarried. My question is this, because I am still so stuck in grieving for both of them. I mean, they were, both of them separately were my life, more than I can even explain. And yet, I am still stuck on them not being with me. I used to talk to my mom and or see her every day. Talk to my mom on the phone 4 or 5 times a day, And my dad, he lived up the street from me because he was sick and he wasn't able to take care of himself and my house wasn't big enough. So I moved him up close to me. And I used to bring him to all his appointments. And I am still stuck. Mm. And I just don't know how to get out of it.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Professor DeVries, here you hear this young woman, these loved ones were her life. She is stuck in her grieving. What do you tell her?
I think to give yourself a bit of space and some amazing credit for all that you've done, and to appreciate all that you're now going through, and to maybe shake off the notion that somehow we should get over this or we should recover. Certainly, everybody is entitled to, my hope is that this will be true for her to feel better, as Anne has described. You know, not to get over it, but somehow just to realize, to put it in some context that allows it to be a part of her life, but not the focus of her life.
Mm-hmm. Back, Anne, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I don't know whether you're working now or you're not working, but clearly, you know, I do remember when my children were just about your children's ages, and I do know that they are very absorbing, but they start to have their own lives and their own needs, and that leaves you somewhat stranded. And if you've lost your parents, whom you were caring for and so involved with at the same time, you're caught in a particularly hard place. And I would just think that the more energy and focus you can place on doing something outside of your home, the quicker you will find your own footing again. Because, you know, women do get caught between the generations, and then they get left by both generations, and that's really hard.
Jane, may I add something?
Okay, Professor, please.
Thank you. In recent theory and in some of the work around grief, it's just as Anne has said, that the idea that it isn't just a psychosocial or a psycho-emotional process. You know, you've heard from several callers and Anne speaking of, you know, learning to cook for one, to shop for one with the death of their spouse. But those activities, much as Anne was saying, to invest in activities outside of the home, also ultimately serve as a distraction from grief, and that respite from grief can bolster an individual saying, "See, I can do this. I can have this break," and it serves to cushion the grief a bit and make it more likely that these outside activities can take place. And it sort of ladders up like that, allowing an opportunity for an individual to not only address those psychosocial issues, but to sort of spread out and take some space away from that and engage in activities that might be successful outside of that, that help cushion those psychosocial issues.
That's good advice. Let's go back to the phones. Squeeze a couple more in here. Pam is in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Pam. Thanks for waiting. And if you could please be brief.
Thanks for having me.
I'm running out of time. If you could be brief, Pam, thank you.
Yes. I just call this period of time life after death. My husband died 25 months ago, and so his death is very apparent, but it's also the death of who I was in that life with him for over 30 years. And going through all the different stages of life, we were the only ones that had certain memories, and now I'm the only one that has those memories. It's just a very odd sense of time, both looking forward and looking backward.
Pam, thank you. Thank you very much. Professor, you say, I've read in your work, to lose a parent is the loss of the past. To lose a child is the loss of the future. To lose a spouse is the loss of the present.
Right. Is this how our you know, what's, much as what this caller just said, what's organized and what's involved in these intimate relationships? And clearly they're not mutually exclusive, but so much of our relationships with our partners are in our day-to-day lives, and how do those lives manifest, or how are we in those lives in their absence?
As we're wrapping up here, Anne Royfe, I wonder if you would just tell us, what's the most important thing you'd like us to know about widowhood, about this season of life, and about the grief you've endured?
I suppose the most important thing I have learned is that one does go on. I have had thoughts about not going on. I have gone on. And that is, in fact, almost a line from a Beckett play. But it's true. You know, you think you can't, but you can. And I don't want to add anything to that. I don't want to say you can dance away, you can jump away. I just want to say you can go on, and each person in their own way. I also wanted to say that, you know, I lately have been having thoughts about summer camp. I remember how wonderful it was to be on the green team and how nice it was to play every morning with 8 friends. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking, why don't I have a camp to go to now?
I hope you do. And when you do, have fun. Anne Royfe, thank you so much for a wonderful hour and a beautiful book. It's called Epilogue, a Memoir. Thanks for your time today, Anne.
Thank you very much.
All the best. And Brian DeVries, a professor of gerontology at San Francisco State University. Professor, thank you for your insights.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.